This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wirednews. Coming up today, virtual reality that can help people be less paranoid, who is the creator of Bitcoin, and how Google can see your medical records. You're listening to episode 266 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess. Joining me on this episode are Emily Reynolds.
Hi.
And also Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
So, guys, what have you learnt this week? Emily, you can start us off.
Okay, so once again, I have a kind of silly fact, but I really liked it, so I'm going to tell you anyway. So before Disney settled on the names for the Seven Dwarves, they had an incredibly long list of suggestions, and some of the more unusual, unused names for the dwarves included Tubby, Goopy, Puffy, Sneezy Weezy, my personal favourite Snurfles, and Awful, which is pleasingly concise.
Matt Reynolds, can you compete with that for a fact?
I cannot compete with that fact, but I've got a fact about a coffee pot that was the inspiration for the world's first webcam. So this was in University of Cambridge Computer Lab in 1991, and the people there set up a camera that was trained on a coffee pot in a separate room, and they streamed that footage on their local area network so that everyone could see on their desktop computers whether that coffee pot was empty or not. And a couple of years later, in 1993, when browsers got the ability to display images online, they put that stream on the internet and it was the world's first webcam.
That's a pretty old fact there from 1991. And coincidentally, mine is also from 1991, but involves NASA, not a coffee pot. In the year, NASA sent jellyfish into space and they were chemically induced to breed. Initially, they sent up 2,478 jellyfish. And by the end of the time that they were in space, how many do you think had actually bred?
I'm going to go with they had 10,000 babies.
So quadrupled, basically.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to closer to maybe 50,000.
That's actually a pretty good guess, Emily. There were 60,000 by the time that they had actually, the experiment was over. This week, we've seen the saga of the creator of Bitcoin's identity resurfacing in the press. For those that aren't familiar with Bitcoin, it's a digital currency that involves the mining of coins using computer power. All transactions that are made using Bitcoins are on a public ledger or the blockchain, and as more Bitcoins get created, it takes up more computer power to actually make them. And these can all be traded online between people, and there's a public record of every single transaction that takes place. And up until now, the creator of this cryptocurrency has been known as Satoshi Nakamoto. This is all we've known about him since Bitcoin came around in 2009, and there has been just very little information about him. He's just an unknown person.
So who is this guy?
Yeah, this week there have been a couple of reports in the press saying that the identity of this man, has been revealed as Craig Wright. The BBC and both The Economist spoke to this Australian computer scientist who claimed that he was the original creator of Bitcoin. In December, our sister publication, Wired in the US, also claimed that Wright was likely to be the creator of the currency, but didn't actually go all the way to say, yes, it is him. So now we've actually got Wright coming out and saying, this is me. I am Satoshi Nakamoto. And during his research for the story, Wright actually provided the BBC and The Economist with some digitally signed messages that supposedly contained the cryptographic keys created during the initial stages of Bitcoin's development. So he tried to prove it to them. And since then, his claims have actually been doubted quite widely on the internet. There's been a very widespread criticism of the methods used, saying that the news organisations might have been duped, they might not have actually, it might not actually been him. And for example, one post on GitHub by a expert in Bitcoin said that he's reasonably confident that he could have sold the news organisations the same story with about 2 hours presentation. So it's one of these areas that is a bit grey at the moment. So it's been disputed that this is Wright may be Satoshi Nakamoto, and also he may not be.
So what's he going to do now? Is he going to, you know, back himself up and prove who he is?
So while this has all been out on the internet, there has been a lot of background things going on here. And Wright today, actually, as we're recording this podcast, about an hour beforehand, has published a new statement online saying that he can't actually prove that he has the evidence that he is the creator of Bitcoin. He hasn't fully gone out there and said that, no, it wasn't him, but he said he now can't provide evidence. And before this, he was saying that, yes, I see your criticisms, but I'm actually going to give you some more evidence. And he's actually put a pretty emotional blog post online now, and I'm going to read directly from it because it is titled just "I'm sorry." And in this post he said that, "I believed I could do this. I believe I could put the years of anonymity behind me. But as the events of the week unfolded and I prepared to publish the proof of access to the earliest keys, I broke. I do not have the courage and I cannot do this." So now we're in this sort of grey position where we don't know if it is him or if it isn't.
But haven't other people also claimed to be the face of Bitcoin, or other news organisations have sort of claimed that they've found who it is?
Yeah, that's right. So in March 2014, the US magazine Newsweek claimed to have uncovered the face behind Bitcoin. So they named a 65-year-old man, Dorian Nakamoto, as the currency's source. But Nakamoto denied the link, and now he has plans to sue the publication. The Bitcoin community also rejected the Newsweek story. And separately, in 2014, a hacker who claimed to have accessed an email address belonging to Nakamoto threatened to expose the real identity of the secretive creator.
So despite all the publicity about Nakamoto and Craig Wright in this week in the press, we still don't actually know. And this is one of these stories that is probably going to run and run. And there may be more people who claim to be Nakamoto. There may be more stuff that comes out of Wright eventually. He has said at the moment that he's not going to publish this information, this proof that he is the creator of Bitcoin. But maybe he will change his mind in coming months, because he's obviously convinced some high level reporters at the BBC and The Economist that he has got the credentials to be this person. But whether he can prove it, we'll wait to be seen. Emily, this week you have been looking at some virtual reality and medical applications.
I have. So lots of people probably think of VR as in a kind of gaming setting, but it's been used in lots of different instances to treat lots of things like autism, PTSD, depression, things like that. And now an Oxford University study says that it could be used to reduce persecutory delusions in patients who've got paranoia.
So this is a recently published study where some academics looked at using VR to actually treat people and try and treat people with paranoia.
Yeah.
So what are these persecutory delusions that actually they were looking at?
So people who have conditions like bipolar or schizophrenia, who often have delusions, they feel like people are seeking to harm them, whether that's physically or psychologically. So they often engage in kind of avoidant behaviour, which will reassure them in the short term, but actually kind of reasserts their paranoia. So a good example is someone might feel like they're about to get stabbed by a stranger on the bus, so they get off the bus early. And because they've avoided the threat of being stabbed, they feel like getting off the bus and avoiding the situation was why they were safe, rather than no one was going to stab me. And so the research sought to kind of treat this cycle of avoidant behaviour and kind of nip it in the bud.
And in the particular study, what was the method that they used? What was the actual scientific procedure behind this test?
Well, they compared it to exposure therapy, which is basically where you gently expose a patient to the things that make them feel anxious or threatened. So patients were asked to expose themselves in a kind of real life situation that might make them feel paranoid. So kind of getting on a bus or walking to the shop. And then they were asked to rate how strong their conviction was in the delusion that they had. And then other patients were exposed to a VR experience. So they were experiencing the same kind of things, only in this kind of safe virtual reality situation. And also asked to rate how strong their convictions were. And compared to the patients who had just had the initial exposure therapy in real life, the patients who had the VR therapy had a significant reduction in their paranoia.
And on the wider context, what does this really mean for VR and mental health care? Because actually, last week we were all away at the Wired Health event, which is our yearly celebration of companies and presentations from companies informing people about the latest innovations in healthcare technology. And VR was quite a big theme there. So on a wider sense, what does this new study really mean for VR and healthcare?
Well, I spoke to Daniel Freeman, who was a lead author of the study, and he's a professor of clinical psychology at Oxford. And he said that he thought VR would start to have kind of a central role in mental health care in clinics and wards. Previously, this kind of thing had been incredibly expensive. The machines had required like specialist training and it cost lots of money. But obviously now VR has kind of much more accessible. So he thinks that it's not going to replace kind of traditional therapy, so things like clinician-led therapy or medication, but he thinks it's going to be used alongside it. And he said it was particularly effective in patients who hadn't actually responded to that kind of traditional treatment. So it could be used kind of as a supplementary thing in all kinds of mental health care.
And for virtual reality and healthcare in general, this is something that we did see quite a lot of, as we mentioned, at the Wired Health event, which you can read all of our coverage online now. Matt Reynolds, when we were there, you particularly covered a story about, which I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, but virtual reality in surgery. Can you just give us a quick recap of that? Because I think it's really interesting to sort of show how virtual reality, which is very much an emerging tech and something very big in 2016, is actually being used across in real life situations.
Absolutely. So the very short version is a cancer specialist and surgeon at the Royal London Hospital recently broadcast virtual reality surgery, real surgery on a 70-something-year-old patient that was having a tumour removed. He broadcast this in 360-degree virtual reality that you could view in your Google Cardboard viewer. So what's really interesting about this is not as a kind of gory form of entertainment, but actually the way that this could educate students and, surgery students and practitioners in, say, third world countries where they don't have access to these really, really expensive ways of performing surgery and testing surgery on either, you know, dead bodies or in a kind of crowded operating theatre. So really important VR for what it can do. It can bring 13,000 people into the operating theatre at the same time. So it's really, you know, really exciting applications.
Yeah, and I think they mentioned actually during their talk at our event that there was people from 142 different countries actually using this and as a training tool. But here with this latest study, we've seen that yes, there's applications for treatments as well. And without diving into anybody's personal lives here, would either of you two be interested in virtual reality treatments if these were a thing that did happen in the past? In the future, sorry?
Yeah, definitely. I would be really interested in, you know, doing any kind of like mental health thing with VR. I think it's really interesting. So if any VR experts are listening, then email me and I'll come and test your VR.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I think that, you know, VR provides what is, you know, as this study shows, a kind of safe environment where you can simulate reality in a way that's hopefully less threatening. So I think for me personally, that's really exciting. And, you know, I'd definitely be well up for any VR healthcare in the future.
It's definitely one that we'll keep an eye on at Wired in the coming months. And to keep vaguely on the theme of healthcare, Matt Reynolds, you've been looking a little bit at a big story this week that actually broke at the end of last week, but has been widely picked up this week, concerning Google and its artificial intelligence company DeepMind that it purchased a few years ago, and their access to hospital data from the NHS.
Yeah, so before I jump into the NHS bit, I'm just going to recap who DeepMind are, what they are. So Google DeepMind, you know, it's Google's artificial intelligence company. They're best known for creating the AlphaGo program that beat the South Korean Go champion 4-1 at the game Go, and that was back in March. So, you know, brilliant at mining data and making decisions. Very clever program. What's interesting now is they've been given the access to the healthcare data of 1.6 million UK citizens. And so this data was handed to Google by the Royal Three NHS Trust. And this concerns particularly patients who pass through three hospitals in London. That's Barnet, Chase Farm and the Royal Three.
So what kind of data did it contain?
Right, so this, we don't know fully all the data, but we know it's some very sensitive stuff, like whether patients might be HIV positive, if they'd had drug overdoses in the past, or even abortions, and this relates to medical data from the last 5 years. It also includes day-to-day hospital stuff, so, you know, for instance, did they come in at X time, who came and visited them? So a lot of both healthcare-based and more general personal information about patients.
And this story is one that was first published by The New Scientist, to give them full credit on this story, because they're the ones that broke this. But it's one of these ones which may have been on the cards for a little while, because, Matt, have we known about DeepMind's willingness or wanting to work with the NHS for a little while now?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been on the cards for quite a while. In February, Google announced it was working with the NHS to build an app that would help hospital staff monitor patients with kidney disease. And essentially, this is where the data has come from. This, on the surface at least, this data is going to be used to help perhaps inform clinicians' decisions or give earlier diagnoses of people with kidney diseases. But I think what people didn't quite realise was the extent of the data involved, and perhaps the fact that it, you know, it covered these 1.6 million people. But NHS spokesperson said this isn't unusual. They have 1,500 confidentiality agreements with different providers, and I think that perhaps people are so interested in this because we know what DeepMind is capable of, and we're thinking, wow, you know, well, what are they going to get out of that data?
And what have Google said? Because that's the NHS's position. So what have Google actually said?
So Google told the New Scientist that since there's no separate data set for people with kidney conditions, they needed to access all of their data to run the app, which is going to be called Streams. So they needed all the access to all this data to work effectively. They've also said that they're creating... Well, the New Scientist, I should say, the Google haven't necessarily confirmed this, but the New Scientist found out that they were also developing another app called Patient Rescue. And this was, again, a kind of early diagnoses and... diagnostic information app that might involve much wider data sets. So there's some sense that this data is being used in a wider project, but really details on that are pretty thin on the ground, pretty murky at the minute.
And that's been one of the biggest issues or controversies why this has been picked up in the press so much, that about what is going to actually happen with the data. So people have got concerns about whether it's going to be used properly. And we must stress that Google probably are going to use this sort of data properly. And they have publicly said that they've got good intentions. But it's depending on how this is going to be used. And I've asked the Information Commissioner's Office, which is the regulator around data protection issues and things like that. They've said they're looking into this as well and the data sharing, because they've had a few people contacting them with some concerns. So Matt, do we know what's actually going to happen with the data at this stage, or is this all up in the air and we don't know?
Yeah, it's quite up in the air, really. I think we're yet to see how this app will play out. I think certainly concerns around this at the minute are not so much that people don't trust Google with their data, because I think that Google have a reasonably good record of keeping people's data secure. I just think that, you know, the sense is that Google are a private company that make money, and that people are a bit concerned, well, who are you going to sell this data to? But, you know, for their part on that, Google have assured they're not going to sell that data onto any third-party company. However, we know that Google does encompass a lot of companies anyway. So, you know, how much of a guarantee that is, you know, it's still very, very up in the air. But we don't really know moving forward what this data is going to be used for. We do know, however, that Google has to either, basically destroy that data by September 2017, because that's when their current contract with the NHS runs out. And furthermore, the NHS is, well, Google has contracted a third-party contractor to keep that data safe in the UK, so it's not going anywhere else. And they're clearly taking patient security very, very seriously, as you'd expect.
And Emily, you've been quiet on this one for a little while. Where do you stand on the position of, would you be comfortable with your data being shared to these sort of companies?
I mean, I guess the issue here is like whether you've consented to give your data. So, I mean, I would be happy in certain circumstances to maybe give up data to certain apps, you know, about, you know, say it's like a mental health diary or something, moods, etc., that kind of thing. I guess it's just that the NHS have given it, and I think a lot of people weren't aware that their data was going to be, you know, was going to be shared with Google. People might not want to share things like whether they've had an abortion or whether they're HIV positive, and I think that's where the problem is.
And Matt, any thoughts?
There are kind of two issues. There's one, the kind of privacy one, but I can be convinced on that if we think that what DeepMind is capable of is amazing, you know, making amazing connections and decisions through vast amounts of data. And I just think that, you know, doctors don't have the time or the capability or the computing power to create links between things that we might not realize are, you know, factors that interact when it comes to diseases. So I think that, you know, I'd say a guarded, yeah, I think it's really interesting, because I think, wow, you know, what might we find out that we don't know? With obviously all those caveats that, you know, it needs to be properly used. But I think that the potential of finding out really interesting stuff is really there. You know, let's just hope that, you know, it doesn't get into the hands of nasty people.
And clearly this is an issue where there are a lot of unanswered questions still, and people are going to be probing into this in the coming weeks and months. So I think this is a story, again, that is going to run for a little bit, and we'll obviously be covering it on wired.co.uk. At this point in the show, we're saying goodbye to Matt Reynolds.
Goodbye.
And also Emily Reynolds.
Bye.
After the break, we're going to welcome Wired's deputy editor, Greg Williams, to the show to talk about the latest issue of the magazine. The issue covers businesses that are focused on their purpose as well as their profit margins. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Everything from Paysos to PayPal to Apple Pay to whatever comes next. Braintree's simple, flexible SDKs make your job and payments easier. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/wirednews. Welcome back to the show. I've been joined by Wired's deputy editor Greg Williams now, and we're going to discuss the latest issue of the magazine which has just come out. And the magazine has got a theme of profit and purpose, or a features packet of profit and purpose. So what do we really mean by profit and purpose when we describe it in this issue?
So what we're fundamentally talking about is a different approach to business. So, you know, we see a lot of kind of apps and a lot of kind of startups thinking about how can we deliver food to people, you know, within 3 minutes, and how can we, you know, wash people's clothes and get them returned to them within sort of 6 hours. This is a different way of thinking about business. It's thinking about being profitable, but also targeting social impact. So it's a commercial mindset allied to purpose. So let's just sort of step back a little bit. So for most of the 20th century, you know, if you think about kind of economists like Milton Friedman argued that basically there is only a sort of a sole responsibility of business, and that is to deliver profit to the bottom line, to add to shareholder value, and to just deliver, to create as much wealth as possible. And I think that what we're kind of starting to see with you know, not just startups, but also some large corporates as well, is a rethinking of this. And this is driven not just because they're trying to sort of think about sort of some of the kind of lofty aspirations of the world and changing the world and social responsibility, environmental stewardship, employee satisfaction and community. It's also, I think, reflective of a kind of a broader change in the workplace. So if one thinks about millennials and the fact that they are, if not already, going to be the dominant within the workplace in the next sort of few years, there are a lot of kind of issues that they face, a lot of challenges. Youth unemployment is very high. You know, the world is fairly unstable at the moment. They're inheriting a lot of problems. There's an existential crisis to some degree going on, whereby a lot of people in their sort of 20s and 30s know that they'll never have the kind of material wealth, say, of their parents. And to some degree, profit and purpose is a kind of a reflection of this. It's saying, business is saying, we need to give the people, our people, a reason to come to work in the morning. And that reason is because there's a higher purpose to what we're doing here. So it's both a kind of a reaction to that, but also, if you're competing for talent with people who are, you know, have high degrees of ability, and there is a talent war obviously going on, you know, in every business at the moment, one way of getting good people to come and work for you is to give them something more meaningful to do. So not just delivering, you know, profit to the bottom line, but actually, you know, solving hunger or delivering goods and services to people in communities who normally aren't looked after in certain ways, or dealing with pollution or some kind of environmental issue. So I think it reflects a kind of both the challenges that we face in the world, but also a kind of a widespread dissatisfaction with the way that we've been working. One of the things that we talk about is the fact that there was a 2013 Gallup poll in 142 countries, and only 13% of employees describe themselves as engaged in what they're doing. The UK, it was 17%, which is really staggering when you think that, you know, whatever, the massive majority of people are travelling to work every day and they're not engaged by what they're doing for, you know, 8-10 hours of the day.
You mentioned there millennials, and I fall firmly into that bracket of that age bracket. And I can see that sort of position of going to work, doing something and trying to want to change the world, have a mission driven behind it. So what sort of businesses are we covering in this package, and what sort of companies do we speak to, and who is doing this?
Right. So, well, the way that people are thinking of it is that purpose is the point and profit is the result of that. And you're able to basically create greater value by trying to sort of do something meaningful, something worthwhile, than you are otherwise. So these are not NGOs. These are not businesses that are looking for a handout. They're not looking for anyone to sort of give them a leg up. These are businesses that are run in the way that the most kind of cold-hearted capitalistic businesses are run. And they're a really broad sort of cross-section of businesses. So one great example is Kickstarter. who last year in September 2015, they basically reincorporated themselves as a public benefit corporation. And what that meant was that they kind of committed to refusing to sell user data to third parties, never to campaign for public policies unless they align with its mission and values. And they decided not to use loopholes or other kind of esoteric legal tax management strategies. So that's one kind of company. Then there's sort of, you know, a wide range of other sort of services, both in kind of, you know, in hardware. So we looked at a company called Little Bits, which is on the cover, the founder of which, Aya Badir, is on the cover, which is basically an engineering company. It's kind of teaching kids to be engineers through using these sort of small bits of hardware, almost kind of like Lego. Medium, the publishing platform, very much kind of trying to sort of like think about its impact on the world. Schools that are run, they're for-profit schools in the developing world where the public education system's failed, but they've managed to create a model where it's very low cost to send your kids to the school. One company, Opower, which really kind of did lead the way when it came to kind of behavioral economics to energy usage. Actually, I think someone told me today got sold for over $500 million. They're kind of very much in that space as well. And there's a company like Patagonia, which has been around since the 1970s and really has had a, you know, kind of counterintuitive approach by saying, actually, we need people to consume less. So they're focusing on things like repairing and restoring things. So it's a really broad range of businesses, both large and small, both kind of quite corporate. Another interesting one is Warby Parker, which listeners in the United States will be very familiar with, not so much in the UK. They're basically an eyewear brand in the United States, and they kind of their profit and purpose has been baked into the business from the very beginning. So, you know, if you buy a pair of glasses from them, they will actually invest some of the profit in ensuring that there are eye care facilities in developing world countries so that, that people there are able to sort of share in their success. So I think there's a kind of like a real sense of this being quite a large movement, that it is something significant and offers a real opportunity to businesses to kind of redefine themselves and both kind of communicate with the outside world that this is who they are, but also to drive meaning for their teams, meaning that they're able to hire people and also people come into work feeling, actually, I'm really engaged, I'm really excited about what I'm going to do today.
And so you've mentioned that these are from quite a few different businesses, backgrounds that are actually getting into involved in this movement. Do you think there's one particular driver to this, or is it something that is a bit larger?
I think there is a sense in which we've seen kind of the global economy kind of collapse in 2008, really by, you know, what to all intents and purposes was a massive scam that was kind of perpetrated, you know, with the full knowledge of a lot of people, just really just pushing paper around. You know, there was really, you know, no value created for the world by that kind of whole nonsense. You know, it really was just short-term profit maximization that, you know, enriched a few people but didn't kind of bleed out anywhere else. I think we're seeing two things. One, I think we're seeing more of a long-term view being created. So that what was interesting is February this year, the CEO of BlackRock, which is pretty much, I think, the world's largest investor, they've got trillions of dollars in assets, he called out short-termism, saying that, you know, today's culture of quarterly earnings hysteria is totally contrary to the long-term approach we need. So there's this going on. Business are now thinking, actually, we need to be in for the long term. Secondly, I do think that there is a kind of cold-hearted capitalism about this. It's about creating value fundamentally. And today's demographics and today's mindset mean that if you really want to create long-term value and you want to really maximize your profits, you need to be able to motivate your team and also have consumers understand that you're something more than just, you know, trying to sort of get them to spend as much money as possible. They're buying into your brand because you're doing something that they can believe in.
And if there's one thing to take away from the whole this whole package in the magazine, what would that be?
The one thing I did find surprising actually was just the sheer number of businesses that are doing this. And this isn't just startups that are baking this in from the very beginning. This is large corporates that are rethinking the very nature of their business and are divesting themselves of companies within their portfolio or brands within their portfolio that don't somehow have a long-term mission-driven purpose.
Thank you for joining us today, Greg.
Thank you, Matt.
Well, that's it for the Wired podcast this week. The latest issue in the magazine is out now, so you can go out and buy that. We'll be uploading it all to the website across the month as well. And as well, on wired.co.uk, we'll have daily news updates as regular. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back next week.